Honorable, today's date is February 19th, 1973. The time is 1 o'clock in the afternoon. I will be interviewing Edmund P. Fisher, a Chippewa and Ottawa Indian of Michigan. The topics to be discussed are Indian events, starting with the 1819 treaty to the turn of the century. Side 2 is devoted to his personal life. And now, Mr. Fisher.
Well, first I would have to speak about the 1807 treaty was the big treaty that was in the state of Michigan as the first treaty of any proportion. There were treaties before this that were made, and they run up in the Upper Peninsula where the government had placed their army barracks or forts in these different little treaties, or they were ports and harbors, what they wanted at that time. Then they come back into, after the 1807 treaty, they come back into the 1819 treaty with the Saginaw, Swan Creek, and Black River Band of Chippewa Indians. And in this treaty, they started from a point what they called White Rock near Harbor Beach. They went west towards Lansing, up through to Kalamazoo. They went to Kalamazoo. When we got up to Kalamazoo, they headed to within about straight north in a line, almost in a direct line, to about 22 miles west of Alpena. Then the line come right straight back into Alpena, back up the shoreline to the White Rock again, and that was the territory that was meant in the 1819 treaty. Now in this 1819 treaty, I have a great-grandfather who was allotted 1 mile square of land, 640 acres. His mother's name was Minaw Kamagokwe, and her Indian name, that was her Indian name, and her English name was Gloria D. Bernard. And there's no record of the English name, which I've gotten through the National Archives at Washington. And this woman bore 3 sons, 1 daughter. And each son got a section of land, one in Saginaw, and the other one was in Carrollton, Michigan. Now the daughter, all women did not receive anything at this time. Well then, after this treaty, we had to jump all the way back up towards where, what is now Flint. Flint was not known as Flint at that time. Flint was at Lapeer. And where Flint is today, at the highest point, my grandfather Fisher was, his father, Chief Fisher, received 640 acres of land. His name was Chickbuck. And his other name was, he had 3 names, Chickbuck, Gene Visker, and Chief Fisher. Now he had his land, and also there was 11 parcels of land right where Flint stands today that were in the 1819 treaty. And there was a Jacob Smith here that took five of those sections for his children. The rest, I cannot read you right off what who they were, but there was 11 parcels in there. Then we had to go back to the Saginaw Reservation again, and here we pick up the place where they used to pay off their Indians. That was on the west side of the Saginaw River, right where today the Fletcher Oil Company is along in there. These people used to gather there, and they would always have a big powwow, and the white people here in Bay City was wondering whether they were going to be massacred or what, but they were just having a little powwow of their own till they got their money, and then, of course, they would drink it up. That'd be all it would be to that. That money didn't last long, and it wasn't too much money at that time, as each one did not receive too much of an annuity at that time. So that was how that money was dispersed. Then, after this treaty, there was a treaty made on the western part of the state that come from Kalamazoo over and went down the west side all the way up through to Alpena, back up across the straits, up near Houghton, and then back across to Escanaba, and then back down the Lake Michigan shoreline back to about Grand Haven again. And that was all in the Ottawa Treaty. That was made in 1836. And those people have their claims in for the land. But the U.S. government is very, very slow in disbursing any money or any claims, as they as these people have been 26 years trying to get their claims. And they, as yet, no one has received anything. It's a shame that this country has to be so slow with Indian payments when it's only a mere maybe $1 million. We give away billions to foreign countries, but they do not want to settle with the Indian. So these poor people are still sitting there waiting. And let's see. Then these people in the Saginaw Valley had another treaty drawn up. Now, when this government made the 1819 treaty, they reserved a lot of reservations along the Caucon River, the they called it the Auglaize River, Augray River, and up around towards Flint. There was a little spot in Saginaw. So after they, 1837, then this treaty was made, they just took more land that was not taken by the Indians, and then they pushed the Indian that far much farther back. So when the 1837 treaty came out, about this time, President Grant was wanting these Indians who wrote the 1807 treaty, the Pottawatomi Indians, to remove to the west, as all our treaties do state that the, after each treaty, in there are articles where the Indian would be removed 5 years after the signing of the treaty and the acceptance by the president. So in this treaty, why, they just took the people and they moved them out with the army, sent the army and moved them out with bayonets. And poor old people that couldn't travel, they fell by the wayside and died and were left alone. And women with babes in their arms, they were left on the wayside. They couldn't continue. Why, they just left them. They didn't have any care for any human beings, whatever. And a lot of these Indians did go to Oklahoma, and they accepted land over there, and quite a few of them struck that oil, and the oil strike was in Oklahoma. Others weren't quite so fortunate. They went north, and they went up into the Upper Peninsula. And I should relate this part partially, because these people have been left, as you'd say, squatters. They didn't have any land, didn't have no money to buy any land, but the government was listening to their plight for quite a while, so they bought the land. And when it come down to all this land that the government bought, the government used these people's own money to buy their own land. And they still don't have a title to their own land, because the government will not release it to these people, as they are not, they claim they are not capable of running their own business. Now in this, after this treaty was over with, in 1837, everything rode pretty good, until 1855, up comes another treaty. But in this treaty, the United States government gave the Indians 6 townships of land in Bay County, 6 townships in Isabella County, 2 townships in Bay County. And these people made selections. Right today, I have the 1883-1885 allottee roll of the Indians who made selections years ago. And there are a lot of Indian names which I cannot decipher. And some do have English names alongside the Indian name. And some people I do know that were in that Alati role. This has been very, very rewarding to me, because in searching for ancestors, a person can always sometimes get to the Ashland office at Wisconsin, and through their land office, you can trace a few ancestors. Now, they don't have everybody's. I have found that out. But they do have some. Now, I have found some for myself, and some I couldn't get. So this way, with the land Alati roll, I was tracing ancestors. And this was a big problem for me, because in my searching, I did not know anybody too many, not too much of the people. I did know a lot of people, but I mean, that were old enough when I started searching, because I was too old. I'm one of the old ones now. So in other words, I probably could be called one of the older Indians. And the people past my age are hard to find. I did find a few, and I did get information, which did help me. And that way, why, it was rewarding to me. Now, after the 1855 treaty, we have another treaty coming back up in 1864 with the Saginaw, Swan Creek, and Black River Chippewa Indians. This treaty was where the U.S. government authorized the Methodist ministry or missionaries to establish a school 1/2 mile west of Mount Pleasant and 1/2 mile north. And they were, the government was to see that it was always kept in order. So that was the start of an Indian school here in Michigan. Now this school operated until about 1893. In 1893, the government took the rights away from the missionaries, and they established an Indian school, which did run up until 1933. Now, this school was a great, great help to these people, as folk did get some education, as they learned how to farm, they learned how to run a boiler, they learned how to be plumbers, they learned how to be, they learned how to be seamstress. Some of them learned to be tailors. Some learned to be musicians. So it was in a rewarding way that this school did help some people. And as we talk about schools, I will have to talk about the Indian school at Carlisle, Pennsylvania, as that was the biggest Indian school in operation. My mother went to school there from 1889 until 1899. And I understand that she graduated from the Carlisle Indian School. And in this school, you had the same training as what they did have here. So in all, it did help. But I often heard my mother mention when I was smaller that while she was at school, they used to send Eskimos to this Carlisle Indian School, and here they taught the Eskimo children to speak the English language. And that is very hard for anyone who has followed the Indian language to turn around and talk English and try to understand English. And that is the one big downfall of the Indian people. Now, myself, I have been educated in a public schools in Mount Pleasant. When I was about 3 years old, my mother and father never talked Indian language at home because they wanted to leave us start and learn the English language. And I have been very thankful for that, but in the long run, I would have liked to have the Indian language, as it is something when you hear people talk, but I can stand and decipher some of it, but not all of it. I couldn't decipher a whole speech, and just partial. And I kind of resent that part a little bit, because I I would like to know more Indian. Now this was back in the early days when I did know a lot of people. There was Frank Chigham, there was an old Tipsico, and there was Henry Ayok, they used to call him Ben Cedarut. And these people were old settlers around the reservation. So this all was in the around the 1900s. Now, I think I will jump over here and give a little explanation on how I did get on this Ottawa roll of the Grand River Ottawas. Now there are six bands of Ottawas on the Grand River Ottawas. That is not pertaining to the main Ottawa band. This Grand River Ottawas was a different band, and they were affiliated with the Potawatomis. Anybody can ask me, but I do not know where the connection comes, but that was how the treaties were made, and of course I believe they lived closer to them and they just consolidated them. And in this treaty, these people had to had a settlement back in 1911. I do remember this. Now, I got $19.16 as a payment in that treaty. My mother took the money and bought me a new suit of clothes, which I was very thankful I had the clothes. Now, to define how these people took the census of the Indians in that day and age. This is a very, very long and tedious job to get the names of all Indians who belong to Grand River Ottawas in this payment. They had a man by the name of Durant. So he had some helpers. And in those early days of 1908, this man had to travel by horse and buggy up and down each road in every section of each county, which was a long, long trail. It took this man 2 years with his helpers to complete this task before they could make a payment to the Indians in 1911. And this man had to leave his horse and buggy at places because there were only trails, and go back and find out where these Indians lived, take their names, and then their ages, their family, their children. And through his efforts, he finally did complete his job after 2 years, and these Indians did receive their money. So now, these Indians are back again, and they have won a judgment for $957,432 from the U.S. government. But there's no money forthcoming. As I do realize myself that the government wants to buy a reservation for them so they'll have some land to squat on until they can get better educated and be self-controlling, be permanent for themselves. But it's a long job to try and persuade these Indians, because they want money. They don't want land. They want money. So this here is how this has come about. And I do not know when. Now the Ottawas have an $11 million claim, and their claim is about ready to be processed through for a judgment to see what they'll do. So I don't know how these people are going to make out. It's worthwhile watching. I myself was on the Ottawa. I probably claim about 1/16 Ottawa blood. But under their new rulings they have now, you have to claim one quarter. So I am eliminated from the Grand River Ottawas. And so I am more Chippewa, Saginaw, Swan Creek, and Black River Band of Chippewa than I am Ottawa. So I will follow the Chippewa tribe as I am enrolled in the Chippewa census. So I will have to follow this because I am three quarters, and my children will be enough blood to collect on this program. So here we are sitting here today, just waiting to see how long it's going to take for our government to issue something to these Indians. I did have understanding with Mr. George Cook for Houghton Lake that we were, if we wanted to accept $5.5 million, no questions asked, they would settle with the Saginaw, Swan Creek, Black River Band of Chippewa Indians. But our claim stipulates us to receive $16,500,000. That's what we are suing for. So there is a big difference. So nobody accepted this $5.5 million, as that is a very small portion. So these Indians now will have to just sit back and wait until the Court of Claims gets around and does render a judgment in our favor that our Indians really can use a little money to further our children's education. Our children are really being deprived of the rightful things that belong to them because their schooling would be enhanced so much by a little contribution by the U.S. government. Actually, I did mention my father's education. My father went to school at Duffield, Michigan, and he did get an eighth grade education. He could write very good, and in his learning, he come to Mount Pleasant with his father, and that's how my mother and my dad met. And after they were married, my father, or else about the time they were married, my father took a civil service examination as a rural mail carrier out of Mount Pleasant back in the early 1900s. And he was one of the first rural mail carriers out of Mount Pleasant post office dating back in the early 1900s. I do have a picture of him with the postmaster and the other clerks and rural mail carriers and city mail carriers. This was very rewarding to him because we kind of set up where he was a government employee and he understood what to do. So we bought a home in Mount Pleasant. Our home was at 519 East Pickett. And my mother used to work once in a while at a restaurant, and then she used to pick beans. Now what I mean by picking beans, you run a foot treadle and the beans come on this little canvas and you picked out the dirty beans. That's what you got paid for, was picking the dirty beans, the weight of the beans. And at that time, wages were very, very low. A man could make a dollar, dollar and a half. Somebody might make $2 a day. That was big money in those days. So, in other words, the wage scale was very, very low. And that's why I believe my mother was working to help kind of further our advancement on the payment of our home and getting it so that we could stand on our 2 feet, which did happen later on. And I was glad of that because that gave us children. Yeah, I had one brother older than myself, Elmer Gordon Fisher, myself, Edmund Paul Fisher, And I have a younger brother, 2 years younger than myself, Marvin B. Fisher. So with the three of us going to school, it kind of took a little extra money. And I do not believe at that time the government paid too big a wage with the rural mail carriers. Of course, that was a steady check, though, every month. Then there was so much vacation time each year. My dad used to take these vacations, and we used to make a few trips here and there. We used to go to Toledo, Detroit, and take in the zoos, take in the coaster rides, roller coasters at that time. Why, we had a wonderful time because we'd always pack a big lunch. But we would be gone from 5:30 in the morning until past midnight before we'd get back home, all tired out. But we really enjoyed our time at those there doings. I do remember of my father and mother taking us to what is called Wapol Island. That is across the river from Algonac, Michigan. And you had to ride a little ferry. It's on the Canadian side of the river. And who we met there, I do not know. But it was a relation of my father's. As this was too long ago for me to remember who these people were. And I was pretty small. And then after we would always come back to Mount Pleasant, the train would get us in there, then we'd have to walk home. In those days, if you traveled by foot, and you carried everything that you wanted to carry by hand, and it was a big job. But we only lived possibly a mile or so from this depot, and we didn't have too far to walk to go home. And I was thankful for that. Now, the children of today, they get more advantages than we had then, because most of these everyday occurrences are on TV or something, but at that time, you had to travel quite a ways to go and see any of these great things that were going on, what we thought was great, was in the zoos. See the camels, the ostriches, the elephants, monkeys, gorillas, and stuff like that. Why, I sure enjoyed that. But I must tell you of one time when Buffalo Bill's Wild West show come to Mount Pleasant. It was the one and only time it ever was there. They had a big side canvas on the side, no roof, no covering at all, and this side was to keep the people from seeing what was going on the inside. And here we did see Buffalo Bill. I see him with his mustache and beard, little pointed beard, and I thought that was wonderful, because here we did see the Indians who were in his play at that time in his theater. And they rode bareback, and the feats that these people would do on their horses was amazing. And all the regalia that these Indians had would be splendor, feathers and all. And the cowboys, they had all shiny plated suits, they had buttons all over, everything was really up in good old-fashioned spectacular show, so that everybody could enjoy it. And that there was one of my great, great adventures I did see, was when he had this show in Mount Pleasant, as it never did come back. It always was in some big city, never did get back that far to Mount Pleasant.